number that has been disconnected or is no longer in service. If you feel that you have reached this recording in error, please check the number and try your call again.
And good evening to everybody. The program is off the hook. Apologies, everybody. Apparently, people at the station took the off-hook tone seriously and thought the station was broken. I don't know what's going on down there, but we started 5 minutes late. We're going to end 5 minutes late. How's that? Everybody will be happy. This is Emmanuel here. Kyle is over there.
Yeah, hi. How's it going? How's everybody?
It's hectic. It's hectic. We have in Signal Land, Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
We have Gila.
Good evening.
And we have Alex.
Good morning.
Right, because you're somewhere else.
That's right. It's Thursday here. I'm in Sicily at the moment in Trapani. As I promised last week, I would be in some kind of far-flung remote location. So here I am. Well, happy Thursday.
Welcome to Thursday. I got to say, this past weekend, I met some of the coolest people on Earth. I really did. I'm not just talking about you guys. And by the way, I'm sorry about that mix-up. I haven't seen you guys in so long. I honestly thought Rob was Alex and Alex was Rob, and I was addressing you inappropriately. So anything I said to either of you, I meant for the other. So just take that into consideration, please. It's been so long. It's been so long since we've seen each other in person. But yeah, you know, we had this massive gathering in Queens, and we just met so many of our listeners and so many people in the hacker community that are some of the coolest people on Earth. It's just it's amazing. You know, you have the elevator conversations, you have conversations passing people outside, inside, at talks, and incredible talks as well. Alex, I know you were a major part of this. You had a couple of talks. In fact, there was an off-the-hook last-minute talk because I think your panel canceled, and you weren't able to carry the panel yourself. So you threw together an off-the-hook, ask me anything. I hope you didn't give away too much.
No, I don't think so yet. Sadly, my panel on Saturday had to cancel because our colleague, Dan Nowak, who was really the key man of that panel, got really sick over in Las Vegas a couple of days before, maybe about a week before, over at the B-Sides event associated with DEF CON, you know, that other hack conference that happens in the summer. And so we needed something to fill up that void. I mean, it was such an important slot on Saturday at 12 p.m. And we said, hey, you know what? We're all here. We're all in the same place, physically located in the same vicinity for the first time in a very, very long time. So why don't we put together a panel about off the hook? And it was so cool to see so many people show up and to have so many comments come in from the Matrix chat during that panel that were so uplifting. And it's so nice to know that people are really listening and that our words have made such a difference in so many people's lives. I think we tend to forget about that. And the words of encouragement and descriptions of Off the Hook were so superlative and so supportive. I almost forgot that we get all this criticism about being so political sometimes. So it was a really nice change, I have to say, to receive all this praise as opposed to, criticism. So I'll leave it there. I think that was one of the highlights of the entire weekend for me.
If I could just jump in for a second, is anyone else hearing that music? Because
no, I don't hear
really. Have I really lost my mind finally?
It's a flashback.
No, this is the interlude music between all the sessions, and I haven't been able to get it out of my head in several days, and now I'm really hearing it loud. It's you think it's funny? Okay, now turn it. Okay, I love the piece. I really do. No question about that. But I've heard it way too much, and I just would like a rest. We had this amazing system where updates would be aired on screens and music would play, and it's really not that complicated. Tell me some of the questions that were asked, because I wasn't able to be at that panel except for a little bit when I came in and remembered what your faces looked like.
Yeah, I think some of the questions, right? I mean, Rob, to jump in and help me out here, but I think one of the questions that I appreciated was somebody asked about what were some of the most high drama moments on Off the Hook that you can recall, and the answer I gave to that, and I think this is before you came onto the stage, Emmanuel, but the answer that I gave to that was to go way back to 2000. When
the hostage shaking,
exactly, basically, yeah.
Oh, no, wait, I've got the wrong station. Sorry, that's the other. Okay, never mind.
Well, it was basically like hostage taking because there were a whole bunch of WBAI supporters
that was a police invasion. That was different.
It was, but people were arrested that night too for staying in the station, and that was when, if you recall, way back then, I think. You were the aberration that had a cell phone. Not everybody had a cell phone 25 years ago. And the police were in the station because WBAI was suffering a corporate takeover, as it does, I guess, every, I don't know, two decades or something like that, when you have to deal with that within WBAI. And there was a sit-in. I think it was like the local advisory board or something like that was up at 110 Wall Street on 20th floor and refused to leave.
120 Wall Street.
I always get it wrong. God damn it. Why do I always switch it up? It was 120 Wall Street. Okay. I thought I got it right that time, but I didn't. And you called your cell phone from the station, and I ran out into the hallway and put the phone up to the mouth of a police officer who was announcing that everybody was going to be arrested if they didn't leave. And then that night when we showed up outside the station after a whole bunch of people were actually arrested within WBAI for refusing to leave the station, it was incredible the support that we received outside because it was a drum circle out there. There were protesters outside the station. It was really... I think that was one of the highest drama moments that I could recall.
BAI can organize a drum circle faster than any other radio station in the greater New York metropolitan area. I'm not kidding about that. If anyone wants to call us on that, we will be there. It was a really amazing panel from all accounts. And it's great that we can just throw that together when need be. But there were some other talks as well, some really good talks. In fact, I think most of the talks were really, really good. But a few weeks ago, we had Joshua Aaron on the radio here. He's the guy that wrote the app called IceBlock, which is designed to alert people when ICE is in town or to let people know just what exactly is going on. And he's been targeted by the Trump administration for daring to do that. Basically, the app does nothing more than tell people, look, at what I see. This is happening right in front of me. Apparently, administration would prefer that people keep quiet and not share this information. So he gave a talk. It was a virtual talk. I'm going to just play an excerpt, the opening, because I think that is incredibly strong. One of the stronger pieces that we had. We had so many good pieces, so many good, topics, seminars, lectures, Q&As. It was really incredible. But this is from Sunday, the opening of Joshua Aaron.
Good afternoon.
He can't see you.
I can't see you, but I'm so happy to be with you. And I'm sorry it has to be remote. But listen, happy to be there. And let me start off by saying, good afternoon. I'm Joshua Aaron, the creator of IceBlock, a crowdsourced anonymous platform allowing users to report public sightings of Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents to other users within a 5-mile radius of the sighting's location. I'm sure many of you are familiar with IceBlock, and hopefully a lot of you have it installed, not only for your own protection, but to help keep others in your community safe. After watching Trump's first term, and then reading Project 2025 and hearing his campaign rhetoric, I saw the writing on the wall and knew I had to do something to help fight back. I was raised in a Jewish household, and growing up in that community, I had the opportunity to meet Holocaust survivors and learn all about the history of Hitler's rise to power in Nazi Germany. And when we see 5-year-olds in courtrooms without representation, college students being disappeared for their political beliefs, or babies being ripped from their mother's arms while they're screaming for their children, we are watching history repeat itself. Now, some have criticized me for making this comparison and using terms like Gestapo to describe ICE agents or concentration camps to describe the detention centers, and my response is always the same. If you know your history, you also know that the Holocaust didn't start with the death camps. It started with leaders dividing the people of Germany by making anyone who didn't look like them or believe in the God they believed in their enemies. From there, work camps were built, and those camps are very much akin to the detention centers we are seeing today. We have a camp in Florida called Alligator Alcatraz, and the right thinks it's cute to sell merch, like hats and T-shirts, while pocketing the money for the Florida Republican Party. These conditions are deplorable, with 32 people to a cage, only 3 toilets, and they're told to get their drinking water from the back of the toilet. We've heard the stories of these detainees being zip-tied, made to get on their knees and eat off the floor. And this is inhumane, and the worst part is that over 92% of these people have never committed a violent crime. Just this week, we learned that over 80% of the people detained there are sick with COVID-like symptoms, and they're starting to clear people out, though we don't know where they're being sent next. With regards to the Gestapo reference, we have masked agents in plain clothes or military-style gear who refuse to identify themselves, camp outside of elementary schools, knock down the doors of foster children, drag people out of their cars, and on multiple occasions arrest U.S. citizens because they refuse to look at their identification. They show up claiming that they have a warrant when it's nothing more than what is called an administrative warrant. And while technically a legal document, it's not the same thing as a judicial warrant, and it does not carry the same authority. A judicial warrant is issued by a judge or a magistrate based on probable cause signed under the authority of the judiciary. This is the only type that grants law enforcement the full legal authority to enter private property without consent. An administrative warrant is issued by a government agency, for example, ICE or OSHA or housing inspectors, under statutory authority and is not signed by a judge. It is typically used for administrative or civil enforcement and does not authorize forcible entry into a home or private area without consent. So while an administrative warrant is technically a legal document in the sense that it's issued under some law or regulation, it is not an official warrant in the Fourth Amendment sense. For entry into a private residence or to compel certain actions, only a judicial warrant signed by a judge or magistrate qualifies. They fully believe the law doesn't apply to them and are now accusing anyone they falsely arrest, assault, or detain of assaulting them. That's how this administration can continue to go to the media with their false claims of a significant increase in assaults against ICE agents.
and that is Joshua Aaron, as recorded at the Hackers on Planet Earth gathering this past weekend. He's the creator of the IceBlock app, and he spoke for 2 hours, could have spoken for 4 hours, took all kinds of questions, suggestions about the app, and it was a great dialogue, both technical and social, kind of the epitome of what we do here, talking about the technology that we are facing every day, challenges and setbacks and potential, but also what's happening in our world that makes these apps, these technological advances so vital and so important. And something like the IceBlock app is it's such an incredible tool for people to have, so they are informed as to what's going on in their neighborhood. And I understand, based on that talk, that this week it hit 1 million users. And much of that is because of the unhinged reaction by the Trump administration, where he has been threatened, his wife has been fired from her job, and all kinds of hell that nobody should have to go through he is experiencing right now. So it was a real real honor to have somebody like that be a part of that gathering, and to just see the reaction, to see people wake up to all this. And any thoughts from you guys on that particular talk or any other talk?
Yeah, the reaction to it was really interesting, because some folks were really into it. Some folks got caught up in criticizing, like, the ways in which he chose to do certain things. But the dialogue is important to have. And all in all, it's all helping to get the issue that this is all about more fully addressable in the public sphere. And I don't think there's any underestimating the importance of that.
I saw some of that disagreement, and, you know, in the hacker world, everyone's going to have a different opinion on how an app should be written, how data should be stored or not stored. And, of course, one of the big issues is that this is only available on iPhones. It does not work on Android. And there are all kinds of reasons we won't get into here. We've already gotten into them in a previous show, and he gets into it very much in detail at his two-hour talk. But, you know, the disagreements and the suggestions, they were all done really respectfully, and I was impressed by that. That's why I say these were such awesome people. I include everybody, you know, the attendees as well as the speakers, because we were able to listen to each other, disagree, and just enjoy each other's company, whether virtual or in person.
And I got to say, that kind of fits the vibe of the whole weekend, too, because I think folks knew that it was all the more important, perhaps more than ever before in this event's history, to all pull together and do everything we could to have it go smoothly. I heard good things from the folks I knew who were doing security and other sort of wrangling from you guys and others, and just the smoothness with which things went. And the event itself ended up just being really, really impressive and comfortable, and it felt safe.
Alex, any thoughts? Alex, you there?
Yeah, I think I had a great time. I think there is this very vibrant, you know, grassroots feeling to hope that is really missing at a whole bunch of other conferences that are either too large now or too corporate focused. Like, this conference to me, always since I went to the first one in 1994 when I was a teenager, I was 15 at that one. And this one has always fostered this real true sense of community and a really true sense of collaboration. And I've loved it. And one of my highlights of the entire weekend at Hope was meeting up with people that I haven't seen in many, many years that showed up. People from, you know, 20 years ago that have showed up and said, hey, I've been out of the scene for a little while. Now I'm here again. And just to see how inspired they were by being back at Hope after some time really re-energized me as well. And I think in that spirit and in that vein, on Saturday night, along with two colleagues of mine, Phil Dian and Harry Halpin, we had a talk at 8 p.m. that was about fostering the sense of community between the hacker culture and the hacker subculture and the Ethereum and blockchain subcultures, which are two cultures, I think, that share very much the same ethos and the same vision, but have been historically divided for some years without really any, I think, real explanation for it. There's prejudices that have been bandied about from both cultures, and what we were there to do is to try to bridge that gap, and we called it Bridging the Decentralized Gap, and that talk was just so well received. It was hard to extricate ourselves from all the many conversations that we had with the attendees after that talk, because we were able to demonstrate that, look, the hacker culture and, you know, the real builders from the Ethereum and the blockchain worlds have that same vision, and we're all talking about the same tech, and we're relying on the same tech in the Ethereum world that the hacker culture fought for, bled for, and died for back in the 90s. And I'm talking about things like asymmetric public key cryptography, on which the Ethereum culture is built, and the same kind of shared values with respect to promotion of open source, building out in public, keeping things accountable, auditability, transparency. All these things that I think we were able to bring to the forefront, and that was just so well received because of the sense of community within the HOPE conference.
I thought that particularly with this disagreement that was talked about in Josh's talk, it was coming from a place of love. Like, everybody wants the stuff to work and be safe for everyone. There's just different ways about going about it, and I think each side of whatever, quote, disagreement is really just trying to create understanding about their way of thinking about it, and because they both care, my understanding or what I see in that discussion about something technical or a choice that's made in something is people care very deeply about this issue. Like, it's not that there's one way to go about it necessarily, or that one way is perfect. Regardless of that, people want to figure it out, and that really applies to so many of the other talks that there were in general. But anyway, it's good to see people being complimentary and enjoying something, but also having insight, and that's the kind of way you innovate.
Absolutely, yes. And it's just this spirit of rebellion that I think has always been part of the hacker culture, and, you know, culture in general. I just saw this before coming on the air. It's not attributed. It's one of these things that is being passed around on social media. But it's talking about ICE raids in Los Angeles. And you realize that they can't win because they're not clever enough. And the people that we know, these cool people that we get to hang out with every now and then, they are clever enough. They are positive enough. They're imaginative enough. Listen to this. LA has been and continues to protest against ICE. These protests haven't gotten any smaller or lost any momentum, but social media wasn't reflecting it. TikTok users, realizing that the platform / other social media were censoring, deleting, and shadow banning these protest videos, well, they decided to find a workaround. They're calling it the LA Music Festival. ICE detention centers and other protest locations are stages. The hottest band is Rage Against the Machine. Here's what gear you should be bringing to stay safe at the LA Music Festival. And it worked. TikTok has become a proving ground for a lot of new music, meaning lots of labels and organizations have lucrative deals with TikTok to promote their new artists and music festivals. So they absolutely cannot censor the words music festival or train the algorithm to ignore it, or they risk endangering that very important revenue. So now protest videos are flooding feeds again, but it's the LA 24/7 Music Festival. Truly an incredible timeline we've landed in. That, folks, is how you win.
Fully, yeah. I love that tactic. Just, you have to mix it up. Don't be what's expected in making choices like that. It's really simple. I love that. That's like very clever. Just turn it around, make it function, and in a way that it confuses authority, right?
Absolutely, yes. Gail, looks like you have something to say.
Oh, gosh, yes. No, absolutely. I mean, I was... The spirit and the vibe all weekend was really lovely, and the person with whom I attended the most talks likes to sit in the very front of the room. So it's interesting to be right up near all of the speakers and then to hear everything coming from behind us. It was a wonderful thing to see all weekend. I vastly enjoyed it. And, but not on that topic, talking about ICE stuff, it's also been nice to see the number of mobilizations that are happening, especially around the Delmarva area, as people are kind of pulling together to just kind of surround ICE and stop them from what they're doing. I appreciate that, too.
Absolutely. And it all ties in. These things matter. And the reason we talk about it so much is because our country is going through something it's never gone through before. And here at BAI, we take that kind of thing very, very seriously. And we have a large number of people that can address these topics with all manner of expertise. So it's a station well worth listening to, well worth supporting, and making sure that it's defended against whatever threats are lying in wait. What's happening to PBS and NPR is atrocious, obviously, but it affects all of community radio, and certainly WBAI is in the forefront of that. So whatever you can manage to donate to WBAI, please go to givetowbai.org. Did I get that right? Givetowbai.org? Okay, I'm sorry, there's so many websites. Buddy.wbai.org. Pledge whatever you can afford. Pledge a monthly amount. You know, if you pledge $30 a month, that's $1 a day. That's $1 a day. Are we worth $1 a day? I think this radio station, which maintains this the spirit of rebellion, which does not cave, which survives all kinds of challenges from within and from without, and has been doing so since 1960. Again, we'll match any other radio station that has done something like that. That's worth $1 a day. I would say that's worth $2 a day, you know, and to have something like that, to know that you can turn on the radio and, you know, here's something you won't always agree, you won't always like it, but it's going to be there. It's not going to be intimidated and threatened and basically silenced, like so many things are being silenced these days. I mean, you know, we're talking about radio stations being sold now because they can't afford to continue operating without CPB funding, which Trump is taking away. We have those stations turning literally to religion, because if they sell the station, who's going to buy it? Obviously, a religious group is going to buy it because they qualify for a non-commercial radio license. It's sad, it's pathetic, and it's bad for democracy and freedom of speech. And that's something that we need to stand up for, and we need to fight that. So your support anytime is appreciated. Again, give to WBAI.org, buddy.wbai.org. Those are the websites to go to support this radio station. Go ahead, Rob.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that struck me about so many of the talks and workshops at HOPE this past weekend was so many of them are about individuals and groups who saw a problem that needed solving and figured a way to, here's a way for the solution to that to come from the community, to come from us, to come from folks who are interested in doing it, because the help is just not out there. They have to be the ones who help. And this station is an amazing example of just that. This station is here because of solely because of the people listening to it and the people who have been keeping it going since 1960. That's 65 years of this just because of you there listening. And those of you who can, going to buddy.wbai.org or calling 833-WBAI-NYC, that's 833-922-4692, and throwing in what you can to help keep the lights on, to help keep us all doing what we're doing. None of us are being paid. This is a volunteer operation. This is the only reason it happens. It's because of you. It's because of your help.
That's right. Go ahead, Alex.
One of the things I want to echo here, too, is that, this was a special one, a special hope conference for me. That is because I got to do a lot of things that I didn't ordinarily do. And one of those things was to MC a lot of the talks. And that was very sadly because our friend Greg couldn't make it over to New York. Greg Newby, who usually is over there and emceeing a lot of the talks. So I stepped in and helped. And I'll tell you, I had a hell of a lot of fun doing that. It was really, I think it just made the weekend a lot different to me from any other hope, from the other 15 of them. And I got to introduce talks from Joseph Cox about the FBI sting operation where they ran and basically took over a massive encrypted telephone network. And he told that story. That was like just such an awesome and riveting story. And then that went right into introducing another friend of mine, Emma Best, from the Distributed Denial of Secrets, who talked about the co-option of hackers by intelligence agents and government and other government agents in particular, and why the hacker community should not be so easily led astray by the government to do things that the government wants that are not necessarily in our interest. And then that led right into another just absolutely amazing and really riveting talk, which was by John Kiriakou. And he and I didn't know each other beforehand, but it turns out that John Kiriakou, who was a very high-ranking CIA official who then became a whistleblower, well, he and I actually wound up, we were at CIA at the same time. We knew a lot of the same people, and he told me before the talk that he had written in a very unflattering obituary of my former boss when he had passed away. So it was one of these crazy things. And his talk was just, I think, extraordinary. I've never heard anything like it. He had no slides. He was just using the power of his words to convey an incredible story, an incredible journey. And I think the entire audience there in Marillac, which was, I think, one of the largest auditoriums in Hope, was just completely riveted to that screen. So I had a great time doing that. That was different for me. Sadly, I had to leave early on Sunday, though, because I didn't see the ICE talk, and I didn't get to watch the closing ceremony. So I wanted to ask you about that, Emmanuel. How was the closing ceremony?
You mentioned our friend Greg, and it was quite emotional because as people may not know, but of course if you attend, I hope you do know now, that Greg is battling pancreatic cancer, and it's just a gut shot for all of us to have something like that happen, to have somebody that is such a vital part of the organization, of this program on many occasions of the hacker community, to have somebody go from being completely healthy to that so quickly. It also makes you realize how tight this community can be, because he was part of the closing ceremonies and the entire crowd made it clear that he was in their thoughts. And I think he felt really good about that. But I'm sure we'll have him on. I'm sure we'll talk to him and wish him all the best. We had another talk that was kind of surprising, kind of controversial. In fact, many of our talks are controversial, obviously, at hacker conferences. But this one had somebody who was formerly from Doge. And, you know, there are people who think that you shouldn't ever have anybody who is ever affiliated with Doge on, but what better way to find out some things that maybe Doge doesn't want you to know. Turns out this guy... Okay, I don't know who that is, but don't do that again. turns out this guy still seems to have some allegiance with Doge, just insofar as defending them, defending what they stood for. Now, the way this talk was put together, we had a journalist, Adam Klasfeld, speaking with the former Doge engineer, name of Saeed Levinja, is I believe the way to pronounce it. I'm just going to play an excerpt from that because it really was fascinating, and a lot of people seem to get something out of it.
Meaning. What was your understanding of who Amy Gleason was in the chain?
Well, she was like the acting head of USDS, right? So the EOs explicitly sort of refer to that position, but she wasn't really involved in like any of the Doge, like the sort of Trump Doge Elon stuff.
Mm. One of the reasons that I ask, there's you know, my background. I mentioned I'm a legal journalist, and there are a couple of live cases going on right now about that go to the appointments clause, which is basically the constitutional mandates of how an agency is created, how someone heads an agency. And a question that has come up, and legal journalists have asked this question over and over again, who is the administrator of Doge? And who, during your time, would have been the boss?
Well, there's no boss. I mean, I was working as senior advisor chief of staff in VA, and I was asked to help the agency execute the EOs that Trump signed.
Mm-hmm. But your understanding of who you reported to,
like, well, but what does reported, like, what does that mean? Like,
well,
no one, the federal government is very interesting because, like, in a typical company, you have like a manager, but in the kind of the context of the U.S. federal government, it's actually incredibly flat. Like there's, because it really Congress defines statutory roles, but I was an advisor to the chief of staff, okay. Right? So like if I was, you know, if I had a boss, it was the chief of staff of the Department of Veterans Affairs. Like if he said you can't do this or you should do this, like that's my job to help him run the org. Right.
Got it. But
and he was nominated, I believe, appointed by Trump.
Right. So I think, you know, what you're saying and what is often the kind of live issue being litigated here in a couple of these cases is there's a presentation of Doge of, oh, we're just advisors. Then there's the perception of Doge that Elon Musk was in the White House. He tweets out CFPB RIP, and then the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is they try to shut it down. And it's a kind of question of...
I think he was just being a whistleblower in that context.
What's that?
He's just a whistleblower.
That Elon Musk is.
Well, if he's saying CFPB RIP, right, he's just sharing private information with the public.
That he wasn't at that point... You're saying that he wasn't having a role in shutting it down?
No, correct, yeah.
That he made he had a similar comment. I'm trying to... he said with... USAID, we are in the process of shutting down USAID.
Yeah, the royal we, like Trump and Marco Rubio and Russ Vought.
So from your vantage point, this was just Elon Musk informing the public.
Well, I mean, you know, in political theory, you have like the concept of scapegoats, right? Like Rene Girard likes to talk about, and I think Doge is like the perfect scapegoat because, like, at the end of the day, like who's in charge, like. Trump and the secretaries of each agency. And if Doge, like, you know the meme where, like, someone's, like, getting, like, you know, all these arrows are hitting somebody and, like, there's someone, like, defending them? That's, like, Elon, like, taking all the heat, right? I don't know why he was so interested in doing that. That's just, it's kind of, like, goes back to why he called it Doge. I think he likes being the center of attention and he likes, like, the sort of, like, the conflict of that, which most people do not like. I think USAID was going to get shut down no matter what, you know, part of Project 2025 or whatnot. And Doge was happy to take the credit, and Trump was obviously happy to let them. So kind of, I think, genius, like, political strategy by the Trump admin.
Mm.
And by the media for, by the way, supporting it completely. have done a very good job of like making Doge feel super powerful, even though we have literally zero authority to do anything besides be an advisory body. Which is why the lawsuits won't go anywhere, why none of the people doing the lawsuits have ever asked me, who's on the record of saying all these things, to like do an affidavit or anything. No one really cares. No one really believes that there's a problem here.
And
I mean, there is a problem, but like the people in power aren't really willing to do much about it.
There is a lot there, just in that 5-minute clip. Basically, this guy, first of all, he is referring to himself as being part of Doge still to this day, even though he was fired from Doge. But to say that he doesn't report to anybody, or didn't report to anybody, didn't really have a boss. People pretty much were doing what they wanted to do in that organization. And that those in high power didn't really care what was going on. You know, I think this Doge talk which basically had this guy being interviewed by Adam Klasfeld, a renowned journalist. It's an hour of slow social engineering. You know, where this guy is revealing things that ordinarily I don't think he would think is a good idea to reveal. But with a skilled reporter just basically chipping away at some of the things that this guy is saying and depending on his own arrogance to come back and clarify certain remarks, I think a lot is here. A lot is revealed. And I hope we study this. I hope we look at what is actually being said. What do you guys think?
I could jump in there and say, you know, I think a lot of what he was talking about on the record there with respect to the appointments clause and the lack of legal authority for Doge to do anything except be an advisory body was really, really right on. And it could be something that if the right lawyers were smart enough to latch on to this conversation could actually help to augment some of the ongoing lawsuits that allege that Doge has been unlawfully bypassing constitutional safeguards and the Trump administration has been engaging in massive amounts of executive overreach. And this is quite literally from the horse's mouth. So I think that the implications of that particular talk could be felt much, I think, for quite a long time. I think that there could be, I think, tremors coming from that talk for quite a while, because it was there was a lot of rather important information, I think, that came out.
Rob?
Yeah, I also think it's an important conversation to have had, because even if you don't agree with the things this person is saying, it is very important to know what he's saying, because what he's saying is what they're thinking behind the scenes of the thing that, you know, perhaps is worth fighting against, is worth pointing out how ridiculous the fact of it is. Information is light. Information is power. And information, even from somebody who's talking a load of crap, can be very, very helpful and useful in making things better.
Yeah. And, you know, it's true what they say, that sunlight is the best disinfectant, so having the opportunity. And it appears that this guy was so excited to have the opportunity to just spell this line of just utter hogwash. I am sorry, but if you if you're going to say with your whole chest, oh yeah, he's a whistleblower, it helps to know what a whistleblower is.
Yeah, Elon Musk is a whistleblower. That resonated. That was something.
Like, I almost didn't hear what came after it because I was so taken aback by that. If you're going to say something like that with your whole chest, know what you're saying. I think that this is a lot of the reality televisionification of so much of our culture, and now it has gotten to the highest offices in the land. But also, if you're in a position and you don't know who you're reporting to, you were probably not a great employee, claims of transparency aside.
Or the organization was not a great organization. I think that's a lot more likely there. Kyle, you were tasked with asking questions that came in from the internet. So you actually got to face off directly with a former Doge person and probably a present Doge person, too, from the way he was speaking. What did that feel like? Did you feel like you were coming up to the face of darkness or something? Just, I mean, wow.
That's a very good question. It was a new position, new task that I had taken on, and I will say there were a lot of questions that we didn't get to that we wanted to get to, and when I was looking to my left at the microphone, there were like 10 people lined up. It just seemed like a huge amount of interest in people doing their own clarification and follow-up questions, mm-hmm. but it was very odd. I want to actually hear a bit, or I'll definitely go back and watch more of the beginning part of that, because I hadn't heard some of those other insights that the interviewer had drawn out of the speaker. So for me, it was very weird to have this person give me a one-word answer for something. It felt like a cop-out or something, and they seemed a little bit like jaded and were really taking a long time to not really give much granular insight, and so we didn't really get the answers we wanted. I think everybody was left a little bit unsatisfied in one way or another with what was said, but there were things between the lines, I think, that a lot of people noticed.
Mm-hmm.
And some of it, it just wasn't, I was left unsatisfied with some of the answers that I got, at least to the questions that I was fielding from our virtual attendees. But we wanted to take some time and try to get to it, and there was just it, I think, was said afterwards, this could have been a much longer talk. We should have accommodated. If had we more time, we probably would have had even more interesting findings in it. But it's what we could do. We did our part to learn more about this person's experience, and I'm really proud of people taking it on and coming up with insight to try to have this person think about a little bit more about their role. But it was quite telling.
Well, I was very impressed with the audience just listening. In fact, he even thanked them for listening. But I think it speaks more to just how people are willing to hear something that might be really horrible sounding to them, but at least let it be said so that there is something to counter, something to debate. And I think that's what happened here. I wish it could have gone on for longer. I really do. There was no way to know just how talkative this guy would be. Turned out he was quite talkative. But I think what was said in the time that was allocated certainly is significant. And I think it'll evoke a lot more questions.
Yeah, I hope people do ask some more questions, and just as we uncover more about this agency or non-agency, I don't even think we got a good answer on that. But it would be nice. It felt like the appearance was going to be revealing, but no one really heard a lot of contrition. There were a lot of excuses.
I heard no contrition whatsoever.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't listen to the whole thing closely, but I really didn't hear any. Alex, any other thoughts on this? And also, I wanted to ask you about Harper Reed, too.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't catch the entirety of the Doge talk. I caught the tail end of it. So, you know, a lot of this has been news that's filtered back to me after the conference, and I didn't catch the entirety of it because I was engrossed in conversation with so many other attendees. Kind of almost every time I would enter a room or exit a room, there was somebody there that was interesting and with whom I wanted to carry on a conversation. So that was why I didn't see the entirety of it. But I think this one's going to reverberate for a while. I think that there's going to be coverage about it. I think this one was going to be a really important talk, and probably one of the talks that we'll look back on in 10 years. at Hope 26, I think, at that point, and say, wow, that was pretty incredible. How did we pull this off? I mean, quite frankly, I think there's a lot about Hope that we look back at later on and say, oh my God, how do we pull that off? I think this is going to be one of those for sure. And you want me to talk a little bit about Harper Reed?
Well, in less than a minute, yes. And then Rob has some closing remarks. Go ahead.
I mean, this is a guy who was the CTO of the Obama campaign in 2012, and he came and gave us like an incredibly inspirational talk about, you know, what he did and where he was and what he's up to. And, you know, this is a guy who's like very squarely part of the hacker culture. It just mystifies me that we didn't have him on sooner. Put it that way. Over to you, Rob.
And I just want to give a shout to the listeners who showed up at the Off the Hook AMA. It's always great to get the opportunity to chat with you in real life, hang out a bit. And thank you all for listening and supporting us.
As always, yes, definitely. It means so much to actually have faces to you know, to connect to as well. So it's always great to see people. It always is great to converse and share experiences and answer questions and just, you know, enjoy each other's company. We're going to continue talking on Channel 2600 on YouTube. That happens at 8 o'clock, just a couple of minutes from now. We will be back next week. I believe next week we're doing a call-in show on WBAI. Someone correct me if I'm wrong. Okay, we're set for that. So that means there's no overtime next week, but there's an overtime this week. Again, 8 o'clock on Channel 2600 on YouTube. We'll be back next Wednesday, 7 p.m. on WBAI for that aforementioned call-in show. Until then, stay tuned to what's going on, because, boy, it's interesting and it's relevant, and you have more power than you think. Above all, you're not alone. WBAI is here. And please make sure we stay here by supporting Peace and Justice Radio. Good night.